Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm Caden Damiano. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock its true value and tie your design work to business impact? This show interviews product designers, product managers, and tech leads from places like Google, Domo, Divi, IBM, Intuit, and Uber to find out what makes a valuable product designer and how you can be one as well. Right, hey listeners, I'm branching off the beaten path today. A lot of the guests I talk to are in the digital product space, and more and more the overlap between physical product design and digital product design is being blended because of the Internet of Things and stuff like that. So I always like to broaden my horizons. Path has led me to meeting Aaron Moncour. Did I pronounce that right?
Perfect. You got it.
Awesome. I'm just a man of the world. I just know how to pronounce things first try. I met Aaron through LinkedIn. We just like talking about product design. He has an awesome podcast, but you know, I'll let him talk about all his great accomplishments and all the work that he's doing in the physical product design space. Aaron, can you just quickly introduce yourself to the listener before we get started?
You bet. Yeah, so I started my company, Pipeline Design and Engineering, a little over 10 years ago. We have nothing to do with pipelines or oil. I grew up in Hawaii surfing, and Pipeline is a very famous beach on the north shore of Oahu. And so the company is named after that beach. It's just a throwback to my days surfing in Hawaii. We started the company doing general product design. So it may have been an iPhone case or a medical device or some piece of equipment. And about 5 years ago, we did a test fixture for one of our medical device companies, our customers. And they really liked it. They said, "Hey, we need more of this kind of thing. Can you start doing, you know, equipment and test fixtures and inspection rigs and things like that?" And we said, "Sure." And that has kind of snowballed into what the majority of our focus is these days, which is developing custom test fixtures and automated equipment for medical device engineering teams, We still do the general product development, product design. It's maybe, I don't know, 20, 25% general product design and maybe 75%, 80% machine design, equipment design.
Okay, cool. So what got you into physical product design and engineering? Like what was your path? What made you want to do it? What inspired you to do it?
Yeah, like a lot of engineers, so I'm a mechanical engineer, and like a lot of mechanical engineers, I grew up building things. Legos was a big part of my childhood. I like to, work on my bike. I was fairly mechanically inclined from a young age, and so it felt like a good fit for me. I remember when I was probably 8 or 10 years old, I had this Michael Jackson cassette tape, right, which dates me a little bit. And I loved this Michael Jackson cassette tape. And as an 8-year-old kid, I had this unfounded worry that someone was going to take my Michael Jackson tape. And so I put together this elaborate alarm system that when someone lifted the cassette tape out of its cradle, it would make a big gong and this alarm would sound. And it was kind of a Rube Goldberg thing, with yarn and tape and paper clips and things like that. But I was always into that kind of thing, mechanical stuff from a young age. When I was a senior in high school, I was at the dinner table with my family, and my dad says to me, "What are you going to do in college next year? You're graduating high school, you're moving on to college. What's the plan here?" And I had no plan at all. I was much more concerned with getting to the beach back then than thinking about my future. And luckily, my dad knew me pretty well, and he suggested engineering. And I said, "Okay, sounds good." And that was about all the thought I gave it. Luckily, he does know me quite well, and turned out to be a great fit for me.
Cool. So, mechanical engineering, is that the main path into the physical product design space? Because mechanical engineering covers a lot more than just consumer products, right? How did you kind of find your focus? Because there's also the industrial design path, where it's more of the architect type people, going down that path to get into product design and stuff like that. How did you decide, I want to focus in on actual products that are sold instead of large mechanical equipment and large mechanical fixtures and manufacturing facilities or stuff like that?
Well, I think I got lucky. I was kind of naive back then, maybe I still am, but certainly back then I didn't really understand the landscape for engineering, for product design. I wasn't aware of the term product design back then. I knew engineering, but going to school, I didn't really know. I knew I liked the classes I was taking. I knew that I was mechanically inclined. I liked math, liked science, and so I felt like the major was a good fit for me, but I didn't really know what I was going to do after I graduated. In fact, I remember my senior year, maybe it was my junior year, in college, a company flew me out to, where was it? It was Wisconsin or Wyoming or somewhere not very interesting. And they interviewed me for a position there to design wire harnesses for automobiles. And I thought to myself, wow, this is such a boring job. Who would want to do this? It was just so dull, routing wires back and forth in a vehicle and figuring out how to wrap them and bundle them. And it was not interesting at all. So I got back from that trip and I thought, what is it that I am going to do with this degree? And a friend of mine was really interested in biomedical engineering, and I hadn't really heard of it before. And so I asked him a little bit, what is this biomedical engineering? What are you doing there? And he told me a little bit about that, and I thought, that sounds really cool. He talked about designing new products, catheters and laparoscopic instruments and surgical tools and things like that. And I thought, wow, I like that a lot. That sounds really interesting. So I ended up doing a graduate degree in bioengineering. My undergraduate is mechanical engineering. And through that, I was introduced to a company locally here in Arizona that does product development. And they were kind enough to hire me. And that's how I got my start in product design and product development.
Cool. So you, instead of actually like engineering kind of like the grunt work, you'd rather design the car, right? Like you'd rather like do the, plan the overall engineering of the car rather than the how the wires are going to fit.
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, wire harnesses, that's just one example. I'm not sure how to like categorize that, but I want to be the one working out the mechanism. So it's not just designing the car. It's not just designing the form factor. That's really more industrial designers space. Mm-hmm. I like that area. And in fact, when I started my company, part of the reason I did it was because I didn't want to just do like the hardcore mechanical stuff. I really liked the artistic side of design as well, and I wanted more of an opportunity to do that. But at the end of the day, I'm a mechanical guy, not an industrial designer. And I wanted to be the guy who was designing the mechanisms, doing the mechanical layout, making sure, you know, the clamshell fit together and the PCB had a nice nesting area to go into, and the right springs were being used, and all those things. That was what was really interesting to me.
That's interesting. So where is the overlap between like a industrial designer, and I'm guessing industrial designers do in that industry, do they focus more on the form factor? Are they not solving those kind of design problems where like the parts fit together and stuff? Or is that more of a collaboration between you and the industrial designer?
I think what's really cool about this space, and probably more than just, you know, our engineering design space, but you can go to school to become an industrial designer, and you will have a pretty tight focus, right? You want to understand ergonomics. You want to understand form. You want to understand aesthetics and cosmetics. Or you can go to school to become a mechanical engineer, and you're going to learn thermodynamics and fluid dynamics and calculus and stress strain equations, things like that. But once you get into industry, it's really, I won't say it's entirely up to you, but if you want, you can kind of chart your own path, and you can bleed over the lines, so to speak. So just because you have a degree in mechanical engineering doesn't mean you can't design a path for yourself to get more into the industrial design side of things. And just because you have a degree in industrial design doesn't mean you can't learn a little bit of mechanical engineering. We have an industrial designer on our team, Craig, who's very mechanically inclined, and he does a lot more than just make things look pretty. He makes them functional as well. He has enough of an understanding for mechanics to work out some simple mechanisms on his own. And for something like a consumer product, you know, some kind of plastic injection molded clamshell housing, something like that, he can take it all the way, all by himself. He doesn't need a mechanical engineer to come in and do, you know, the mechanical things for him. So it's I think it's kind of up to the individual as far as where they want to go with their career. And you don't have to be stuck with just what you learn in school. That's a starting point.
Yeah, that's super interesting because, like, yeah, personally, like, my style is I really like approaching engineering from the design perspective, but from more of a software engineering standpoint, hopefully more projects that involve kind of the merging of like physical and like digital, like UX. But yeah, it's like I had to design that, like getting more involved in engineering conversations and bringing the design perspective to those conversations instead of just like, I don't want it to just work. I want it to like hum, you know, like I want it to really perform well.
Right.
Like, I don't want it to just like work. I want it to perform fast. I want it to perform asynchronously. You know, it's like you're actually like striving towards like performance outcomes, which really is pushed from a design perspective, because like, how do you know what performance outcomes to push if you don't know how people, like what the customer wants, right? And you know, there are engineers that come across the aisle, and from that perspective, like they are concerned what the customer wants and stuff, and that they're willing to do the research to inform the engineering design decisions and the mechanical design decisions. But like, that's really interesting. Now, I have a question for you then. You know, you own your own company. Like, then how do you hire then? Like, do you, because is it like, do you just usually look for like generalist mechanical engineers, or do you actually evaluate that in candidates? Like, oh, this person looks like they're kind of a generalist, like they do it both ways. We need that in a project, with someone that could take it end to end. Or, oh, well, we need someone that really just focuses in on the mechanical engineering so that he could be a shared resource or she could be a shared resource on another project. Like, how do you view that then? If, like, talent's so diverse, like you said, like it's so malleable in your industry, how do you build teams?
Sure. Most of our work is mechanical design work. We do some industrial design. So just looking at, you know, the split of the type of work we do, probably 90% of what we do, maybe even 95% of what we do is much more mechanical than it is cosmetic. So right there, it's clear that we need mostly mechanical engineers. And in fact, 90% of our team is mechanical engineers. So it's not too difficult to determine like what type of person we need. What is more difficult is finding those people and finding the ones that are actually a good fit for the team. They agree with the culture, things like that. Does that answer your question, or was there something more than that you're looking for?
Oh yeah. Well, I'm just curious because like I've been thinking a lot recently about talent and stuff like that. And there's like a strategy that I've been discussing with people on the podcast, moving against the generalist job description. Like, we need a mechanical engineer. And it's like, well, we need someone that could focus in on these aspects of the job. Like, these are the kind of projects this person would be working on. Like, we're not looking for someone that does like wiring housing. Right, we want someone that could think systematically how the whole like product will work together. Like, you as the hiring manager needs to be very specific in the job description on like what you want that person to do. Like, what's your vision for this new hire, right? And some people are like, oh, you know, like, hey, problem solving is problem solving, and like, you know, you can just pick like generalist designers. Our designers are just pick generalist engineers, but I've found in my experience that not all engineers are created equal. Some engineers just want to be told what to do. Other engineers are more creative technologists, right?
Sure.
Like, there's a difference, yeah. Right?
Well, I think the great thing about mechanical engineering is it is kind of a generalist engineering degree. Mostly you're focused on mechanical, but you have exposure to electrical engineering, civil engineering, chemical engineering. So you get exposure to all these different areas. And when you graduate, you have a pretty solid base of knowledge to build on. So when you hire a mechanical engineer, they're pretty versatile people. You know, they, if they don't specifically know how to do something, one thing that we learn in school as engineers is how to learn. I think that was probably one of the more important things that I picked up in university was how to learn. And so a degree in mechanical engineering, you're pretty versatile. If you don't know how to do something, you can figure out how to do it.
Cool. So like that's more of, would you say that's like the ethos of that profession, is that it is kind of adaptabilities hammered in?
I like to think of mechanical engineers as professional problem solvers. So throw your problem at us and we'll figure out a way to get it done.
Okay. Tell me about like a recent project. You talked about like a Nintendo Switch mount to a controller. Like, how did that engagement happen? How did you guys approach the problem? And because I'm just curious to see, like, what the process is, like, of an engagement, right?
Yeah, so we knew a company. We'd done some work for a company. And one of the engineers who was working at that company ended up inventing this really cool holder. It's kind of a coupler between the Nintendo Switch Pro Controller and the Nintendo Switch itself. So it would grab on this device, this product that he invented would grab onto the Switch, And then it had this arm that kind of extended down and grabbed onto the Pro Controller so that you could hold the Pro Controller and not have to hold the Switch by hand, and it would just be suspended in air, you know, a few inches above the controller, so you could play the game with a comfortable viewing angle, not have to prop up that Switch, you know, against a book on a table or something like that. And since we knew him, because we'd done work for the company at which he worked, he reached out to us and he said, "Hey, I invented this thing. I've got an investor. I've built a prototype. The prototype works great. It was 3D printed. He was just 3D printing these. And he said, I need to update the design with design for manufacturability involved. In other words, right now I'm 3D printing this. We need to produce it in high volume, which means plastic injection molding. And I need you to take my design, which was never intended to be injection molded, and update it so that it can be injection molded. And at the same time, if you can add some styling to it and things like that, maybe we pick out some different friction hinges, that would be great too." So that's how it started. And we actually put our industrial designer on this because he's very capable of something like this. And he styled it, you know, he made it look nice. And we did some 3D printing prototypes ourselves. We ended up working with a company in China to manufacture some custom friction hinges just for this product, which is called the Fixture S1 is the name of it. We have factories in China that we work with, and so we pulled one of those factories in and sent them our data package and said, you know, give us a quote, and help the our customer go through production, getting first articles and reviewing those, and then he's selling them right now. So that's kind of how that one went.
That's cool. So, like, was it up to the industrial designer to define, like, what a comfortable viewing angle is? Like, how do you guys test that out? Like, the ergonomics and stuff? And
yeah, it was collaborative, for sure. And, I mean, part of it is just, like, standing there with the Pro Controller and having someone else hold the Switch and move it up and move it down and tilt the angle back and forth and saying, how does this look and how does this feel? And eventually, we settled on a range that we liked, and then we just reverse engineered that range into a physical product.
Cool. Yeah, that's cool. That in the digital product design space, that's called like a Wizard of Oz prototype, where it's a human supported.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's like obviously someone's pulling the levers to test out.
Right.
Yeah, and
man
then
behind the curtain.
Do you guys test it out with like real customers as well? Like once you make a like the initial like concept that you're going to use to like mass manufacture, do you like test it with like real people or like your kids or?
Yeah, depending on the project, we'll get more or less sophisticated. But for this one, we weren't super sophisticated. We all tested it ourselves. The inventor, he was is a big gamer himself, so he did a lot of testing. And then it's funny you mentioned my kids. My son is really into the Switch. He loves playing Fortnite on it. And so I gave him one of the prototypes, and he loved it. And
Cool.
He was one of our biggest fans. And his friends would come over and be like, "Hey, where can I get one of these?" So that was kind of fun. But we had some user testing in that sense.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, that's always interesting to me because, you know, this is such a new world for me, understanding, like, the physical design space. Like, it obviously, you have to have relationships with, like, manufacturers. You have to understand, like, the materials that you need to use. Like what kind of plastic you use? Like, isn't there like a bunch of different types of plastic? Like, I read the James Dyson autobiography, and he always like talks about because he was an industrial designer, and he's always talking about like what kind of polymer he was going to use and stuff. Like, is that the case?
Yeah, there's tons of different types of plastic. I have a funny story about that. When I was first married, maybe just a year or two into when my wife and I got married, We were walking down the street, just taking a walk after dinner, and I was looking at my phone case, and I was kind of studying it, and I do this a lot. I'm always looking at physical things and trying to understand how they were made. I think it's really interesting. I love manufacturing. And so I'm studying this case, and my wife looks at me, and she says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm trying to figure out what material this case is made out of." And she looks at me like I am the biggest idiot in the world and said, "It's plastic." And I'm like, "Okay, but there are hundreds of types of plastic." And she was blown away. She had no idea that there were all these different types of plastic. So it's like a running joke now. We look at each other sometimes and just, "It's plastic." But yeah, you're right. There are lots of types of plastic. There are probably just a handful that are really commonly used, like ABS is a really popular choice. ABS-PC, the PC standing for polycarbonate. That's a blend of ABS and polycarbonate. Polycarbonate by itself is a really common material. Nylon, UHMW, Delrin. So there are, you know, probably, I don't know, a dozen or so really common plastics used for product design.
Yeah, and so how do you go about, like, is there any, like, problem-solving frameworks that you guys use to decide, like, what the constraints are and like what the use cases are to start kind of making like recommendations for what kind of materials you need to use?
Not so much for materials. Usually, like I said, there's just a small handful of materials to choose from. And for example, if you were going to use something in a wet environment, you would not want to use nylon because it will absorb moisture and actually grow in size very slightly, but it will grow in size over time. So if it was going to be in a wet environment, you probably would not want to use nylon. And I don't want to say that material selection is always simple. It's not always simple, but oftentimes it's fairly clear what kind of material to use. In terms of processes, just the design process in general, one of the biggest things, especially as you get into working in teams and not just as an individual, but even as an individual, it's so critical to put together requirements, like a product requirements document, and have specifically listed out what is it that this product is supposed to do. I can tell you from personal experience, unfortunately, that even if you think it's clear what the product is going to do, your customer might have a slightly different idea of what the product is going to do. In fact, early on when I started Pipeline, I had this project to develop an iPad case. And the customer told me that they wanted to be able to use it in the kitchen. So it should, you know, be kind of splash proof and prevent any gross water ingress. And so I said, okay, that makes sense. And I developed this case, and I gave her a prototype. And she said, "Okay, great, I'm going to go put it underwater and see how deep it'll go before it starts leaking." And I said, no, don't do that. It's not intended to be waterproof." And she said, "Well, what do you mean? I thought we talked about that." And I said, "Well, no, we didn't. She thought we had, and I didn't recall that conversation, but there was no like formal document that said this product must do this thing and that thing and that thing." So putting together a formal requirements document is, I think, really, really important. And it's so easy not to do, partly because you get excited about jumping into the design, right? And you just kind of skip by that. But then also partly because it's so easy for us to assume that everyone on the team understands exactly what it is we're trying to accomplish, when there are subtle nuances between, you know, people's understanding of things. So putting that formal requirements document together, written down, and having everyone buy off on it, that's a super important part to the beginning of every project.
Does your team like to be involved in like the process leading to the creation of that document, or do you just like to have the document like written and given, handed off to you guys? Like, do you like to influence what goes in that requirements document, like going through the process and making sure that like there's reason, like well-reasoned logic behind the requirements?
We do. Yeah, we do. You know, sometimes we'll get a customer who says, "Okay, here are the requirements. It has to do these things." And we might dig into that a little bit and say, well, why does it have to do these things? And we might find that the customer has made an erroneous assumption that led to a requirement. And once we understand the why behind that requirement, we might say, okay, we understand what you're trying to do. Thank you for explaining that. This particular requirement probably is not the best way of accomplishing that why. So we definitely like to be involved in that process.
Cool. Have you ever had... like, I know you get involved and you've specialized in like mechanical, like medical device testing, right? Is it medical device testing or just testing of any kind of?
Most of what we do is for the medical space, but we do equipment for, you know, all industries.
Okay, cool. So that's more of just like a niche business decision. Like you want to be the best at that because it's good for business, right?
That's right.
Have you ever thought about working on like Internet of Things type technology, like working on hardware, like electrical engineering type stuff before as a team? Have you ever worked on stuff like that?
No, we have not. It's not part of the roadmap. One thing that I've learned is you can be very intentional about the direction of your company, and I think you should be. Mm-hmm. I think you should also be open to where the market organically steers you. For example, we started off Pipeline just focusing on general product design. But 5-6 years into it, the market started directing us towards this, you know, test fixtures and automated equipment. And that's probably something that we never would have identified on our own. But our customers wanted it, and we saw that there was a market for it. And so based on that, we made a strategic decision to make that the focus of our company.
Cool. So that was just an example of, you know, like the business is for like the customer, like it isn't to like fulfill your, this is more of like a work-life balance question. Like you go into it thinking, you start out general because you just want to solve problems, right? But at the end of the day, you know, it is just a job and you're like, okay, well, I want a job that generates a lot of money so I could provide for my family and stuff, right?
Sure. Yeah, you need to make a profit. It's damn business.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, saying that's a really great example of really being like, well, hey, we got to be in business. I like solving problems, but it isn't like my identity as a professional, like, or as a person, right? Like, you probably like spending time with your family. So, I mean,
sure.
But at the same time, it's like medical device fixtures is very specific, right? How do you do anything outside of work to exercise kind of like your curiosities? Like, is there anything that you like to learn about outside of like your professional like framework that you've built for yourself?
All right, I have a couple points to address. So the first one is I want to make sure that I have been clear that I don't feel like it's a compromise at all that we've gone into this equipment design. I really like it. I mean, mechanisms and motion control and automation and all that stuff, I find these things really cool and interesting just inherently. So that's one point. And then to address your question about like what do I do to scratch that creative itch? I interviewed a guy on my podcast. He sold his company for a lot of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And I asked him, you know, what do you get bored of doing what you do? Do you ever wake up and think to yourself, I think I'm kind of done with this. I want to go try something else. And he said, you know, I don't really have many interests outside of work. I really love my work. And that was very reassuring to me because I feel the same way. And sometimes I feel guilty about not having other hobbies, you know, like, I don't know, playing the guitar or bird watching or whatever. I really like my job, and the fact that I'm the owner of the company allows me to explore, you know, kind of whatever I want. A good example of that is it turns out that Costa Rica is becoming a hotbed for, well, has for some time, is a hotbed for medical device manufacturing. And I didn't know that before. So recently I learned that, and I have had several conversations with contract manufacturers down in Costa Rica just to learn more about what they do. Not because there's any specific goal I'm trying to reach right now. But I think to myself, I've been to Costa Rica. I like Costa Rica. I would like to be there more often. There is this like medical device manufacturing hotspot going on there. Maybe there's something I can do to like join these worlds together, you know? And just having the opportunity to explore different ideas, that's really fun for me. I love putting together systems and strategies for doing things. And as a business owner, I mean, that's really what I get to do every day. I don't do that much actual design work myself these days. My team does that, and I focus a lot on just how do we communicate better. What processes should we be using? How can we make product design more efficient within our company? So there are all sorts of things that I get to be creative about and think about in my role.
That's really cool. So I mean, like your creative endeavor is the business. You spend
really
your time
is.
Growing the
yeah.
business, and you know that you bring up a really good point on like. On the outside, medical device fixtures doesn't sound sexy, but it sounds like it isn't just like good business for you to focus in on that. It's also like a problem that you are obsessed with a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. I think it's fascinating. It's a big puzzle that you have to figure out, you know? And it's perfect for me and my team because we're all mechanical guys. We like mechanical things, and it's figuring out how do we, you know, move this lever in just such a way, but prevent this, you know, unintended motion at the same time? And you ever watch the show House? It's over now, but you know what House? I've
seen a couple
talking
episodes.
About. Yeah, it's maybe before your time a little bit. But he's a pathologist, and someone asked him on the show, "You're like, why do you do this? Why do you, you know, you must love people. You must love helping people." And he's like, "I don't care about people. I like solving puzzles. That's why I do this. It's a challenging puzzle to put together." And I won't go so far as to say I don't care about people, but at the end of the day, the job is fun because it's a puzzle that I get to solve.
Yeah, it's less about the concern, but I'm sure there's like really bad consequences if like there isn't testing equipment out there, right? So there's like, you want to make sure that it's really good performing equipment because people could potentially die.
Absolutely.
If you don't have good testing equipment. And so.
Yep, absolutely. That's right. There's definitely a satisfaction in what we do because we know that down the line, this is going to ensure a medical device works properly, and that medical device is going to help save somebody's life.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a really good example of vision, right? One insight from my podcast is that you really shouldn't go into business. Like, you know, if you want to own a business, you shouldn't go into business unless you have something that you're obsessed with. Like, and for you, it's the solving of problems. Like the methodical deconstruction of mechanical problems and like manufacturing and like solving that puzzle. And then you also get to go kind of above the craft now and actually think like strategically, like, oh, like how could we get more involved in like Costa Rica and how could we solve the problem while having a good excuse to expense flights to Costa Rica, which is that's like the fun creative aspect of life,
yeah,
right? Like
absolutely.
You get to
absolutely
you get to kind of curate how you live your career, and that's really cool.
There's a professor at Harvard Business School, Clayton Christensen. He's written a lot of books.
May he rest in peace.
Did he pass away?
Yeah, dude, he passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Just last year, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, what a loss.
2020,
but he wrote
man.
A book called, 2020. Jeez, what a crazy year. How Will You Measure Your Life? And did we talk about this before?
Not on the podcast, so go ahead.
Okay. It must have been someone else I talked about. But anyway, he wrote this book, How Will You Measure Your Life? And one of the stories he tells is of himself as a younger consultant with, I think it was McDonald's. And McDonald's hired him to help them sell more milkshakes because the world needs to drink more milkshakes, right? Anyway, he took this job, and the way he framed it, I thought was so interesting. He framed it like this. He said, "What is the job that people are hiring milkshakes to do for them?" And that allowed him to, you know, think more strategically and get a clear understanding of the problem and then how to solve the problem. And I've thought about that a lot. And so I think to myself, what is the job that I have hired my job to do? You know, like, what do I really want to get out of this at the end of the day? And I've encouraged my team to ask themselves the same question. What do you want from your role working here at Pipeline? Like, not just from a professional standpoint, but from a personal standpoint. What are you trying to get out of this? I think that's a really important question for everyone to ask themselves. And it's probably not an answer that's going to come quickly. It might take years of reflecting and thinking about that before you start to get a clear picture of what exactly it is you want from your life and then how you can achieve that through your professional career.
Yeah, well, that's a great thing to aspire to, is curating your life to fit kind of like what you want to fulfill personally.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, for you, like, what was like the biggest like setback in your life and your career that taught you that lesson? Like, was it like trying to get a job at like a Doolittle or something like that, and being like, oh wait, this isn't what I want? Like, is there a setback that you're glad that happened that kind of taught you that lesson?
There is, yeah. So in 2009, right, this is kind of towards the tail end of the Great Recession, the company I was working for at that time as a mechanical design engineer, they were getting slow, and they laid me off. And at the time, I felt physically ill, I remember, right? I got laid off. I had to go home and tell my wife that I was losing my job, and I felt sick. I felt physically ill for several days, I remember. And it caused me to think a lot about what I wanted to do, because they didn't just lay me off because they were slow and they didn't have the work to support it. They recognized that I was not fully engaged in what I was doing. And they were right. I had become just not real motivated. So I think they made the right decision to you know, choose me as one of the people that they let go at that time. But it caused me to think, have I just lost my desire for product design, for mechanical engineering? And I started exploring completely different things. I looked into web design. I actually started a photography company with a friend of mine, and we ran that for several years. Commercial real estate, being a broker. I looked into just really different things. And ultimately, my father-in-law pulled me aside and he said, you know, if you want to do these other things, that's fine. But before you go whole hog on something else, consider that you spent 6 years getting 2 degrees in engineering and you have, you know, 3 or 4 years working experience. Do you really want to just walk away from all of that? Or is there a way that you could do engineering that you would really love doing? And turns out he was right. And so instead of, you know, going down some completely different route, I started my company, and I knew some people in the industry already since I'd been working there. So I reached out and said, hey, I'm doing some freelance work. Is there anything that I can help with? And I got a couple little jobs. And very quickly, I realized that I still loved engineering. What I was able to do in my own company that I hadn't really had the opportunity to do in the other company was own the entire process, right? Previously, when I was an employee, I was told, do this, and then do that, and then we'll talk. And so I had a very narrow, a very short leash, so to speak. And when it was all up to me, right, I had to be the one that figured out, do this and do that. And I had to take ownership of the entire process of developing this, not just a small portion. And I learned that I loved having that high level ownership. Instead of being a cog in the machine, I could be the machine. And that was really transformational for me. So I look back and on that time when I got laid off, and I see it as, you know, arguably one of the most, one of the best things that has ever happened in my life.
Wow, that's really awesome. Like, Because that is the realization, right? Like, if you're bored at work, you think it's you, right? Like, maybe I'm just not cut out for this profession. Yeah. But there's a reason you got in there. And I think it's the vehicle you're on that's not engaging you.
There you go.
You're on a bus and you wanted to, like, be on in a Ferrari. And I think it's like, if you're not engaged with what you're doing, maybe you just need to reevaluate the vehicle you're living your career through, right?
Exactly.
And that's a really great insight. Yeah. So, Aaron, like, where can people get a hold of you and, like, learn more about you and the work you're doing? I'm sure it's not just about, you know, engineering. I'm sure your podcast is really great to have conversations like this, you know, like these lessons that you've learned as a professional, right? And
thank you for asking. You can find us. We have two websites. It's a little bit confusing. We have designtheproduct.com, and that's that kind of focuses on our general product design. And then we also have testfixturedesign.com, which of course focuses on the test fixtures and equipment and things like that. And then we also produce a podcast. It's called Being an Engineer, and that's on all the major podcast publishing platforms, Apple Podcast and Google Podcast and all of those. And then finally, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. I respond to inquiries and people trying to get a hold of me. Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, Moncur, M-O-N-C-U-R. And any one of those, you can get a hold of me.
Well, Aaron, thanks for coming on the show. I really love getting your perspective on something I've been fascinated with. Didn't get a chance to really explore it, and just love your perspective and knowledge. And you have just a really great story, really, really inspiring stuff. And just keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Hey, listeners. Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Way of Product Design. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with your network and write a couple lines on why you found it useful. And if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help the show grow, please leave a review on Apple or Google's podcast platforms. As always, thanks for listening. You have a good one.